If you want to support this podcast and get a full ad-free episode, sign up to Headstuff Plus.
Hey guys, and welcome to Personality Bingo with me, your host, Tom Moran. So this week on the podcast, we have the brilliant Paul Howard. Paul is the creator of Ross O'Carroll Kelly, one of the most popular fictional books that Ireland's probably ever produced. It's kind of incredible, the success and the span they've had. There's been tons of books, there's been tons of plays produced by the brilliant Landmark. And Paul's also written two musicals. That's how I met Paul. In 2012, he made Anglo the musical, and we are currently collaborating on Copperface Jackson musical, which is in its final week at the Olympia Theatre. As you listen to this, we close on August 12th, so it's your last few chances to get in and see it. It's probably the most fun I've ever had on stage. The show's been just getting rave reviews, standing ovations, literally without exaggerating at all, every single night. I've never seen anything like it. It's kind of incredible, and it's one of them shows where it's all about the script. I mean, it's kind of impossible to mess it up. So that's just been amazing. As well as that, Paul's done loads of non-fiction work. He's a four-time Irish Book Award winner, which is kind of incredible, and just a really, really nice fella, and someone I'm so glad that I've got to know over the last few weeks. So, as I said, come out and check us in the Olympia Theatre for the last week at Copperface Jackson Musical. It's been such a ball, and I guarantee you, you'll have a brilliant night if you make it out to us over the last week. Other than that, let's get stuck into it. The brilliant Paul Howard playing Personality Bingo with Tom Moran. Paul Howard, ready to play Personality Bingo?
Yes.
Let's do it. All right, so a quick explanation of how it all works. So I've got 60 minutes on the clock, 60 questions here, and a bingo machine with 60 balls inside. I've also given you five numbers in that sheet of paper. Would you do me a favour and read out the five?
Yes. Four.
Yes.
22.
Yes.
49.
Okay.
15.
Right.
And 53.
Thank you very much. And would you do me another favour and pick a sixth number, something between 1 and 60 that's not already there?
Okay.
You can scribble that down and tell me what you're going to go
for. It's 19.
19. Any reason?
No, it was just the first one that came into
Yeah, going
head.
Off instinct. That's a good tactic for this.
Completely random.
Brilliant. Right, let's give it a spin. See what comes out. Oh, yeah, we're having some technical issues here. Should have gone to somewhere better than Argos.
The technology is amazing, can I just say. I'm really surprised by this.
We'll edit all this. There we go, finally. Here we go. First out the gate, we have number 50. Do you have it?
I don't.
No worries. No. Number 50. When was the last time you wrote a letter?
The last time I wrote a letter. I wrote one on Sunday. I do write letters like I haven't. I think all the old ways are coming back, right? Mm. I walked by the old Irish Press building on the way here today. I think the Irish Press is coming back, like, you know. So I keep waiting for it to be the 80s again. But I still write letters. I'd actually sooner sit down and write somebody a note than send them an email.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
That's amazing.
I would, yeah. And I wrote a letter on Sunday night to a very kind gentleman in Kerry who'd written me a letter to say he enjoyed my last book, and I wrote him a letter back. But I'd much sooner do that. I just find it much more personal, you know, than writing an email.
Totally, yeah. Because it's amazing when you get a card or something and you get that feeling yourself and you're like, gosh, I need to do this. But yeah. I haven't gone the step that you've gone to actually put it into practice.
Yeah, I buy note cards all the time, and just, you know, if I'm in a card shop and I see cards that I like, thank you cards or something like that, I'll pick up a box of those, you know. And I'd spend maybe 2 hours a week just sort of handwriting letters to people who take the time to write to me, you know. So yeah, it's not a lost art in my house, you know. I still do it all the time.
That's amazing. Am I right in saying that, okay, if someone wants to give you a compliment about a book or a play or whatever it is, they might write a letter, whereas if they want to have a go, they'll write a tweet? Have you ever got a critical letter?
Yeah, I mean, the letters, you know, critical letters tend to be anonymous, you know. Like, so sometimes newspapers attract very, very extreme people, and you know, so sometimes if I write a Ross that somebody you know, might find blasphemous or something. I might use the word Jesus Christ, the words Jesus Christ in it or something, in a way that they think is blasphemous. They'll write me an anonymous letter, but what they often do is they actually write the letter around, like they tear out the column from the paper and they write the letter on the actual piece of, on the sheet from the magazine, and they sometimes might put a prayer card in or a miraculous medal or something like that. So I just put them in the bin. Like, I don't even look at them. They just, as soon as I see the miraculous medal or the prayer card, that just goes straight in the bin or in the fire, you know.
Yeah.
And but that happens maybe once a year or something. I mean, I wouldn't say it happens often at all. When I worked in the Tribune. When I worked in the Sunday Tribune, this is sort of the days before email. So the only way to get to a journalist was to write to them or to ring them. And I remember there was one kind of letter we used to get all the time, right? If you write, all that glisters is not gold. If you use that idiom or cliche, whatever you want to call it, you will get at least 20 letters from people telling you that the true Shakespeare quote is "all that glistens is not gold." So that was one. And actually, I remember we used to do it for fun sometimes. We used to just put in "all that glistens is not gold" just to see how many irate Shakespeare fans were out there.
Yeah, make them waste the price of a stamp, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Brilliant. All right, let's give another spin. All right, next out the gate, we have number 53. Do you have it?
Yes, I do.
Oh, well done. That's a good start. I can give that a tick off.
Right.
Nice one. Only 5
to go. Do I cross that out?
Yeah, you can cross that out.
Okay.
Nice one. Okay, here we go. Film, theatre, music, comedy, concerts, galleries, anything like that. What is the greatest piece of art you've ever witnessed?
Oh, God.
It is a horrendous question, I admit.
So give me them again. It's theatre?
Film, theatre, music, comedy, art galleries, concerts, a gig, some live experience you'll never forget.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so many, you know. But I mean, I think the theatre experience that I enjoyed most is definitely Book of Mormon.
Yeah.
I've never seen anything like it.
It's
like,
incredible.
You know,
did you see it in London or in New York?
I saw it in New York, yeah.
Yeah.
And Mary and I were just passing the theatre one night, and we'd heard about it, but we didn't have tickets, and they just put house tickets on sale at the last minute, so we got seats to see it, and it was I've never laughed so much in my life. And also, there is that thing of, you're also thinking, how are they getting away with this?
I know.
You know, how on earth can you say such politically incorrect things? And people are all around the theatre are just rejoicing in it, you know. And
do you have an answer or a theory on why you think that is?
It's all about context, you know. And it is that thing. It's that thing that, I mean, it's made by the writers of South Park, and some of the things they say on South Park are just you know, you couldn't say in any other medium. You know, I remember that there was that story a few years ago about that woman on Twitter who said she was going to South Africa from America, and she had a layover in London, and she got on Twitter and she said something about, "I hope I don't get AIDS.
Yeah.
I probably won't because I'm white," which actually is very much a South Park kind of gag, you know. And if you saw it in South Park, you'd laugh. And as it happened in her case, it ruined her life. You know, when she arrived in South Africa, she'd been sacked while she was in the air, you know, and her whole life was turned upside down by this. And it's true, there's a, you know, there is a context in which you can say things and in which you can't. So, and I suppose for a comedy writer, it's always about trying to find the biting point, you know, and maybe push it a little bit more than you should. But it's always a danger there, you know, especially, you know, in the current age where justice is instant on social media. You know, it's you know, you say something that pushes the envelope, and you're immediately censored and you're immediately shut down, and it's kind of terrifying, you know. And I suppose we're all, not just comedy writers, everybody is just one ill-chosen remark away, or one badly chosen word away from ending their, you know, their career or, you know, turning their life upside down. And it's kind of terrifying because, you know, in this day and age with social media, there's never been more pressure on people to be constantly talking, constantly communicating, constantly saying things. And yet the price for saying the wrong thing has never been higher. And it is terrifying. I mean, I love listening to old comedians like Lenny Bruce, you know, who went to jail for the right to say motherfucker, essentially, you know. And in those days, it was the censoring was done by the authorities, you know, and by the conservative establishment. And now it's done by us, you know. Now we the people censor ourselves and censor each other, and you know, we're far more unforgiving, I think, in that regard than you know, the authorities that Lenny Bruce came up against.
Yeah, it's kind of it's even there's a thing of you can be, I don't want to say like guilty by like implication, but for example, like there's certain people, and you know, you'll see them follow someone on Twitter or something, or yeah. or you'll be conscious of someone that you're following on Twitter, and you're like, I wonder, does that like sync up with like the views of my community? You're just quite, like, you're kind of always drawing the spider web. Like, where am I fitting in?
And it's peer pressure. You know, it is. It's like a big playground. You know, and if you don't follow the cool people and agree with the cool people on everything, and if you don't, you know, use the correct language, or you know, it's you're in trouble. And it is, and like I said, it's far more unforgiving than it was, say, 50 years ago, because it's peer pressure. Like that, you could like a comment on Twitter, just like a comment that somebody else made, and suddenly make the national news, it's a terrifying vision of the future. You know, I mean, I don't know what it's going to be like in 20 years time. I don't know where the social media thing is going to go. I know a lot, you know, more reasonable people I know are getting off it, because like that, the pressure to conform and the pressure to be somebody you're not as well. That sort of virtue signaling thing on Twitter especially gets to you after a while. You know, the fact that, you know, something happens in the news or some great event happens, like, you know, repeal the 8th or gay marriage, you know, things that I never thought I'd see in my lifetime, you know, like really, really amazing, momentous things. But then you feel, well, I haven't actually said anything publicly on this on Twitter, and the pressure just to sort of say something, just to let people know that you feel a certain way about this thing, it's just huge. You know?
And it's so dishonest.
Well, yeah, it is dishonest, and I think it's really boring as well. I'm talking about the sort of the general need to sort of seek approval for certain positions, you know, because. None of us is 100% virtuous. There's no such thing. And we learned this, you know. I grew up in a country, you know, that was where priests made the laws. I went to a school called Archbishop McQuaid National School. You know, I know from my past experience that there is no such thing as virtue. And people who pretend they're virtuous are just who say they're virtuous are just pretending. And it's, you know, and it's just pressure. It's just a pressure to, you know, constantly state your views. I just find it really dull.
Yeah.
Just find it really, really dull.
Yeah. Totally right. Let's give it another spin. All right. Here we go. Number 16. Do you have it?
I don't. No.
No worries. Number 16. What kind of a teenager were you?
Stressed. Just stressed.
What were you stressed about?
Malnourished and stressed. I was stressed about everything, you know. Like, I was just stressed. My dad is stressed. I can say that because we laugh about it, you know. Like, I come from a family of just generally stressed people who are stressed by the world and stressed by life. You know, my dad is really, really time obsessed, like, you know. So if you say I'll be there at 6 o'clock, at 10 to 6 he's looking at his watch saying he's going to be late. He's already anticipating you being late, you know.
Yeah.
And I've inherited that, like, you know, it's either a learned behavior or it's in the genes or something. But I was very stressed. I mean, I'd say from the time I was a kid to probably my mid-20s, I would say I was just in a permanent state of stress about everything from, like, you know, when I was at school, it was, you're never ever going to get a job when you leave school. You know, a very nervous kid, like, you know, I couldn't read in front of the class or anything like that. Like, I was just nervous about stuff like that. And just generally full of worry, like,
you know,
pointless worry, and skinny, like, you know, and that might have had something to do with the worry. But I couldn't, no matter what I ate, I just couldn't put any weight on. So I just looked really, really malnourished all the time.
Yeah.
I'd say that's the kind of teenager I was, you know, just nervy and stressed and. I suppose, like, I grew up in the 70s and the early 80s, when it was a pretty miserable time to live in Ireland. You know, like, you did have a sense. Certainly when I was at school, most of my friends knew they were emigrating when they left, you know. We had a school reunion about 5 years ago, and I think there was like 15 people from the 120 people in our class were there, because most of them were either in England or America. Right. And that's what the 80s was like. So it didn't kind of breed that sort of sense. Like when I look at young people now, if I go and do some read, I do a lot of, like, Ross O'Carroll Kelly readings in colleges and schools. And when I meet young people now, they're completely different to the kind of kid I was, or the kind of kids my friends were as well, you know. Like, we would never, I don't think I made eye contact with anyone until I was about 22 or 23.
Right.
You know, I couldn't maintain eye contact in a conversation because I just kind of had that sort of complex or something, which is a very kind of Irish thing, I think.
Mm. And so what was it in the mid-20s or whenever you came out of that brought you out of it?
I think mixing with adults, like, you know, when I left school, I worked in a postcard factory in Cabinteely, and it was great because I went from kind of just being around kids all the time, like in school, to suddenly being around grown men, you know, and you suddenly learn to speak up for yourself. And, you know, and then when I went into newspapers as well, it was, you couldn't do the job of a journalist if you weren't confident in some way. And I suppose I learned it, like, you know, to be able to go to press conferences and ask questions, and you might be the most hated person in the room for asking that question, but you've got to ask that question. Like, that kind of thing, that sort of just teaches you. And I suppose it's maturity, really, you know. That's what it was, I think.
Because I just listened to you talk previously about going into Vincent Brown and he was, you know, he could be roaring and screaming, but you've seen all that going on with other journalists, and you're like, this is where I want to be.
That seems
oppositional to the who you might have been, say, 10 years previous.
Yeah. And I think when I, the first time I went into the Sunday Tribune newsroom, this was all going on. Like, I was freelancing for a newspaper called Southside, and they were based in the Sunday Tribune building, so it was the same newsroom floor. And I brought my copy in. I'd written a story for Southside, and I brought it in hand typed and handed it over. And Vincent Brown was screaming at somebody from his office, and Gene Kerrigan was there, and Ger Barry, you know, people like Mike Malott, Kevin Dawson, you know, David Walsh, Paul Kimmage, like that. Mm. They were the people I was looking at. And I remember Ken Finley, the editor of Southside, said to me, you know, would you be interested in just staying for 4 hours and doing a half shift here? And it was a kind of Friday night, about 7 o'clock, I think. And just, I never wanted to leave. Like, it's just the buzz of the place, the excitement of the place, the hurly-burly, people screaming at each other, people working to deadlines, the stress. I just, you know, I didn't want to be anywhere else, you know? I didn't want to go back to the postcard factory.
If that question hadn't been asked, if you hadn't said, would you stay on for the 4 hours, I know it's almost an impossible question to answer, but give it a go. What would your life look like, do you think?
I think I probably would have done it anyway.
Okay.
You know, they offered me an apprenticeship in the postcard factory as a plate maker. And at the time, it was the late 80s, you didn't turn down a job easily, like, you know, without a lot of soul searching, and especially an apprenticeship, because that was the thinking at the time, that if you got an apprenticeship, you had a trade, and if you had a trade, you'd never ever be unemployed. Now, as it happens, the way printing went, the way that industry just completely changed within about 5 years, plate making was obsolete, you know, it just basically didn't exist anymore. But I turned it down, and I remember being really, really nervous telling my mother and father I was going to turn down this apprenticeship, because, you know, I think my dad and my mum's big fear for all of us was that we would be unemployed, that we wouldn't get work, and we'd have to go away. And so I probably had already made the decision then that I was going to be a journalist no matter what it took. I wasn't going to fail.
Mm. And then if I can move that question on the few years to then when the Ross books start happening.
Yeah.
Do you think you'd still be working, you know, sports writer for a paper if the Ross books hadn't happened and you hadn't moved into the whole, you know, fiction world?
Oh, yeah, because I never ever wanted to write books. Like, you know, I only ever wanted to be a sports journalist. It's the only ambition I've ever really had, is to be a sports writer. I wanted to be a sports writer from the time I was about 11. Mm. And the books thing was something that just happened completely by accident. You know, I started writing this column, Ross O'Carroll Kelly column, for a laugh on a Friday to send up schools rugby. And then with the Celtic Tiger kind of took off, and suddenly I was writing more about the Celtic Tiger than rugby. And they moved the column then into the news section, and then people started to say, this is social commentary, this is social satire, which was kind of news to me at the time. But then, you know, I put a load of the columns together in a book, and it did, you know, reasonably well. And then another publisher came to me, the O'Brien Press, and said they wanted to publish the next one. And then I eventually got a deal with Penguin, and I mean, the whole success of Ross O'Carroll Kelly, it's still a surprise to me. Like, I never ever expected it to take off like it did. It certainly was never in my plan that I'd become a full-time author. But about, it must be 12 years ago now, Penguin, I got a book deal with Penguin, and it just kind of suited me at the time to do it full-time. I'd been writing the books in my spare time while trying to hold down a full-time job. So I was doing them in the evenings. I was writing at weekends. I was taking, say, a month's holiday at a time to finish a book. I took one book with me to the Olympics in Athens in 2004, and I was trying to finish it while I was there, and I was doing sort of 17, 18-hour days between the book and my day job, which was covering the Olympics. And I kind of knew I couldn't keep that up. I knew something had to give. So when I got the deal with Penguin, I just said, well, I'll do it. I'll take a 2-year sabbatical from sports journalism and just see how it goes. And then I never went back, you know. And now the business is just so different to the business I worked in. Like, it's not the same anymore, you know. Like, firstly, the Sunday Tribune, the paper I worked for, is gone.
Yep.
And it's a totally different discipline now, covering sport, to the one I remembered. When I was writing about sport, you cover a match and you were filing a piece for the next day, and the next day actually seemed like that was kind of almost like, now there is no next day.
Yeah.
It's instant, you know. Nobody wants to read what happened in the match yesterday today,
mm-hmm.
because they read about it yesterday or they watched the match. And the whole concept of time, you know, as it relates to the media, has changed now. You know, everything is rolling news now. Everything is instant. Judgment is instant. If somebody plays well, they're the greatest player in the world. If somebody plays badly, they're the worst player in the world. And then it doesn't matter if you're wrong, because you can change your mind tomorrow.
Mm.
And it's a lot less considered, I think, than it was when I was writing for newspapers. So I if I went back and did the job now, I'd probably need to retrain or something, or I'd probably discover I couldn't do it anymore.
Is there ever a part of you that feels like, because that was your boyhood dream and now you're doing something that's kind of wildly different in terms of, you know, you're a author and a playwright and a, you know, all yeah. this sort of stuff. Do you ever feel on some level that it's not a betrayal, but is there that pull of like, this is what I wanted to do and now I'm doing this completely other thing?
Yeah, there is, you know, there are times when I really miss it. Like, you know, I really, really miss it. But the last few years I was covering sport, I was writing so much about drugs and doping. I had definitely fallen out of love with sport by the end. And I know, you know, at a certain level, that's a good thing, because I think you can get too close to it. You know, if you love it, then you sometimes can forget your responsibilities, which is to tell the truth.
Yeah.
And I find a lot of sports journalism that I read now is really just promotion. A lot of sports journalists have just been sucked into the whole production of it, you know, and promoting matches and a lot of the time telling lies. And, you know, I went off to cover the Olympics in 2004, and I had, I think I had something like 16 books with me, and like 13 of them were about drugs. And I could pronounce chemical names that were like 12 syllables long, and I wouldn't even stutter as I was saying them. Like, it just, so much of what I was writing was about doping. I was sitting on a bus with Paul Kimmage at the 2000 Olympics in Sydney, and we were going back to the Olympic Village one night, and four or five athletes got on, and it was really, really hot day in Sydney, and they had their shirts off, you know, and their backs were just completely covered in acne, like, it was like looking at human pizzas, you know. And that's, you know, acne on your back is a sign of steroid use, you know. And it was just how open it was that really shook me, that it was, they weren't hiding their torsos or anything. It was kind of like, you know, this is what we do. So you go into I think you go into sports journalism, most people do, because they love sport rather than because they love journalism.
Mm-hmm.
And the longer you do the job, the more you realize, well, in my case, the more you realize your responsibilities as a journalist and not as a sports fan. But I think too many journalists are essentially fans. And, you know, I just was watching the coverage of the Tour de France over the last few days, and, you know, the really, really meek coverage of the Sky team. I mean, this is the Sky team. I don't know how you can talk about Geraint Thomas's victory in the Tour de France without reference to, you know, the backstory, his team's backstory, what's happened in the last 2 years in relation to his team and his teammates. And there's a lot of that in sport, and you know, so I don't miss that. Like, I wouldn't miss the pressure, to be in a newspaper office and to actually write about something that I didn't believe in, from the point of view of somebody who did believe in it.
Well, that's what I was struck by earlier. We were talking off mic, but you were saying when you were a sports journalist, you knew a lot of sports people, whether it be footballers or whoever it was. Does that then make that pull of that, if you have to, you know, as you said, if you're job is to tell the truth,
yeah,
and if you have to tell the truth about, you know, a colleague or a mate or someone who you're familiar with, was that pull there to be like, well, if I have a go at so and so and then I'm going to bump into them on the circuit, is that a thing? That
to bumping into them never bothered me much. Like, you know, I mean, I covered, for instance, the Michelle Smith case, you know, and I was, you know, one of the journalists from the beginning who doubted this story and wrote about it at the time. And it was very, very difficult in the sense that, you know, you were sort of on trips abroad, like with colleagues who did believe her, and you're the odd one out. And that's tough. But bump into Michelle all the time, you know, you'd sort of see her at press conferences and things like that. And it can be unpleasant, you know, but you've got a job to do, and that's what you're paid to do. But the tough thing is, it's if you have to go to that person and ask for an interview. And that was always the toughest thing. If you criticize somebody openly or doubt them, especially in a country as small as this, you're immediately an enemy. And that's why I think a lot of journalists make the compromises they do. You know, to get access, you have to make those compromises, because it's very, very rare the athlete who you can actually criticize and then ring the next day and say, can we do an interview together?
Yeah.
But the problem, you know, that I always found was that the newspapers wanted you to be both things. They wanted you to write critically in that way. But then they would say, oh, Ireland are playing, you know, Portugal next week. Can you ring up Robbie Keane and get an interview? And you might have, you know, you might have lambasted Robbie Keane for his performance in the last match. I'm just using Robbie as an example.
Yeah.
You know, but that's what it was. And, you know, I think all sports journalists have a similar story in that there's always sort of three or four times in your career when you get close to a sports star and you get incredible access to them. But you have to make compromises. And I did that. You know, I kind of got close to, you know, I was good friends with Steve Collins, the boxer. Mm. I was close to Sonia O'Sullivan. But Sonia was great. You could criticize Sonia and never, ever worry about ringing her for an interview the next time. It was just forgotten. She was incredible, you know, like that. But, you know, but sometimes you would censor yourself. You would sort of say, well, I'm not going to say that because when I meet them next week, that might be a difficult thing to have, you know, if it's in the air between us. And I think, you know, if you're going to cover sport in that way, just doing interviews with people, you have to make all those compromises.
Mm.
But if I was a sports journalist now, I would like never, ever to have to interview a sports person. I think that's the only way to do it.
Yeah. Well, you see, that's why I got this interview with you now, and I'm going to criticise you afterwards.
And I'll still talk to you, Tom.
Yeah, yeah. You just wait for these tweets. All right, here we go. Number 13. Do you have it?
I don't, no.
No worries. Number 13. Aside from sports and sports writing and that kind of thing, do you have any other great passions that you love to follow?
Any great passions? I mean, I've hobbies, like, you know. I mean, I'm passionate about reading, like, and good books. I'm passionate about. I keep bees, and I'm not passionate about it, but I really enjoy it. You know, it's something that really relaxes me. I get passionate sometimes when I watch the news and I see something that drives me mad. But then on another day, it might not drive me mad, you know.
Sure.
I have days when I can get worked up about just the most ridiculous thing on television, and then, you know, and then the next day I just say, "What does it matter?"
Are we talking politics, like? Or?
Yeah, politics.
Is it something you'd ever go into?
No, not at all. I mean, I'm not really a compromising person. I don't have a compromising personality. You know, I couldn't. I don't think I could make those accommodations with myself, you know. And it is, politics is all about compromise. And I've seen, I covered local politics when I was with Southside. And I saw, you know, for just as an example, Eamon Gilmore. And I really liked Eamon Gilmore. I still like Eamon Gilmore. But when I started covering Dunleary Rathdown County Council, he was the local Workers' Party representative, and his power base really was built on his opposition to water charges in the 1980s, and he was at meetings in our house, actually, in Ballybrack when I was growing up, you know, talking about his opposition to water rates and how we shouldn't pay them. And then just before he retired from the Dáil, I heard him on the radio one day explaining how metered water was going to work, you know, how people should be paying for their water by a meter basis. And he'd always said that paying for water was a form of double taxation, you know. And then you kind of think, well, that in the length of a political lifetime or half a political lifetime, he's gone from believing that to believing the exact opposite. And I couldn't do that, you know. And I just wonder how effective politicians are as well. You know, I don't, I watch, sometimes I turn on a Ruckus report or something in the evening and I hear them say, you know, there were furious exchanges in the Dáil today. And then the camera kind of pans out and there's like six people in the chamber, you know, and I don't buy that. Like, I don't believe that the world is being changed by these six people talking in the Dáil, like, you know. I mean, I'm interested in politics, but I don't know. I just don't believe people like Simon Harris and Leo Varadkar are going to change the world for the better.
Yeah. When you talk about politics and then you look at your own writing, whether it's, you know, whether it's a play or a book or a musical, whatever it is, how much of that do you have to navigate? Is there much, like, is there someone like editing you or pushing you in different directions or saying we don't want to go here? Or do you have almost 100% authorship over what you do?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I have an editor who called Rachel Pierce, and she edits all my books. And she's not a silent editor, you know. She's terrific, and she's part of the reason why I'm currently writing book number 19 in the series, because it never would have lasted as long as it has without her voice in the background telling me don't do that or do that. But Rachel would kind of give me nudges when she feels I'm, you know, when she feels I'm not doing justice to a character, for instance, or not doing justice to a plot line, or she feels that a particular storyline is weaker than we had in the last book, for instance. But Rachel would never ever say to me, I don't believe you won't get away with saying that, or you shouldn't say that for reasons of political correctness, you know. If anything, Rachel, you know, she agrees with me that artists should be pushing the envelope. You know, we shouldn't all be signing up to, you know, lists of words we can't say, or lists of thoughts we can't have, or character traits that you can't have in characters you write. You know, Rachel would believe, like me, that artists are there to push those things.
Is there a sentence or a thing that you've taken on that you received the most backlash for?
No, like, I've never really received backlash, you know. Like, I think with Ross, I mean, he started off as a really obnoxious character, and people knew when I was writing Ross, people saw him as obnoxious, and they knew that I was writing him in an ironic way. I suppose the danger is the longer you go on is the character becomes more beloved. And that certainly happened with Ross, that there were, you know, I read some of the early columns I wrote now and some of the early books, and there are definitely things in there, opinions he holds, that I wouldn't write today. And it's not in the sense that I'm sort of self-censoring myself. I'm cognizant of the fact that people have a different relationship with the character now than they had all those years ago. So people who are reading Ross when he was 18 years old in school and saying, you know, appalling things about people who weren't in his socioeconomic group, though the people who read him, because probably the character's actually become a little bit more lovable over the years since he had kids, I know that those things, if I put them in his mouth now, would actually jar. You know, they would jar with me, because I just can't believe he would still think those things in his mid-30s, you know. And it does happen. I think he's probably matured as a character, and I think people's relationship with him, because they like him now. It's like, I was watching an old episode of Only Fools and Horses recently, and it was on UK Gold. And if you watch those early Fools and Horses, it's amazing how many politically incorrect jokes there are in them, you know, that Del Boy tells jokes about Irish people. There was a joke about black people. There was a rape joke actually in one of the, I think it was the first or the second series of Only Fools and Horses, which you couldn't possibly have said, you know, 10 years later, when 25 million people were tuning in to watch the Only Fools and Horses Christmas specials. You couldn't possibly have an Irish character called Brendan O'Shaughnessy. and it is that thing of it, that when people's relationship with a character change, when they look on him differently, it's almost like you've got more responsibility. You have to think more carefully about what you say and where the humor is and where the jokes are.
Yeah, is that in terms of, because even if you compare, even if you look at with the Coppers musical, right, and you look at someone like Gino, what's really interesting about them as two protagonists is, like, overtly, like, if you were to, like, they're not necessarily like likable people from the get go.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, someone having 76 children or whatever with 76 different women,
yeah,
that's not something that, like, societally we give the thumbs up to.
Yeah.
Yeah. They have this lovable, roguish quality,
yeah,
to them.
And there's a cartoonish aspect to it as well. You know, like, if he had six children by six different women that, yeah, he didn't support, I think the audience would go, you know,
yes,
but because he's got 76, it's funny, you know, because and that's what cartoons are, you know. You're taking, and when somebody draws a caricature of somebody, you take a face and you just distort certain features to make it funny. And it's exactly the same when you're drawing a character for the stage, you know, for a comedy show. You just take something that there's an essential truth there and just exaggerate it for comic effect.
Totally. Is writing for the screen something that has appealed to you, whether it be like a TV adaptation of Ross or like something completely different, like a completely original concept for a pilot? Is,
yeah,
that something that you're interested,
yeah,
in?
Yeah, I mean, I've done some stuff. I mean, I for television and for film as well, you know, like, so I did a book about 2 or 3 years ago about Tara Brown.
Yeah.
Who is the Guinness heir, whose death inspired the Beatles to write A Day in the Life. And that was optioned for a film, and I've written the script for that. And I wrote a film script a few years ago called Just Not Cricket, about a kid who grows up playing hurling, and he has the secret life behind his dad's back. He goes off and plays cricket with his friend whose dad runs the local Indian takeaway. And it's kind of a sort of coming of age Billy Elliot type film, and I'm hoping that might there's some interest in that, and I'm hoping something might happen on that in the next year. But I really enjoy it. Like, and again, it's like writing for the stage and writing books. It was never in my career plan. Like, my career plan went out the window about 12 years ago, and now I just go from project to project, saying, "Oh, that sounds kind of interesting. I'll give that a go," you know.
Mm.
But I couldn't. I mean, if someone said, "Where do you see yourself?" That awful question, "Where do you see yourself in 5 years' time?" I have absolutely no idea.
Yeah,
I just have no idea, because, you know, the only thing I'm sort of vaguely trained to do, sports journalism, I'm not going back to that again. That's all I know.
Yeah,
and but I'm just enjoying doing things like this, you know. And yeah, I mean, television and film is something I'd love to do it, like, you know, I'd love to do more of it.
Mm.
I did a sitcom a few years ago. I had a concept for a sitcom that I went to America and pitched it around the studios, and it got bought by E! So they commissioned me to write a pilot. So, but I loved that. Like, I mean, that was, you know, just walking through, all these film studios, you know, sometimes walking through the lot, like, you know, and walking down the street, a fake street where they filmed Spider-Man, to go and pitch to, you know, six or seven executives your idea. It was such a buzz. I just enjoyed it so much.
Across all the mediums that you've written, is there any piece of, like, writing advice that you think stands across them all?
I would say the most important thing is to learn how to concentrate. Especially now, especially in this day and age where there's just so many distractions with social media, the internet's always there, television's always there. I see it even in having conversations with anybody under the age of 25 now, the difficulty in maintaining concentration just to talk to somebody for more than 5 minutes. It's just so great. And the really tough part about writing is sitting down for 5 hours and maintaining your concentration, just staring at that blank screen, you know, that blinking cursor, and not getting up and not going off to have a cup of coffee in the garden. The weather's been so great lately, the temptation is huge. to walk away from the screen. And but that's the first bit of advice I give everybody now. It's just learn how to concentrate. And it is a discipline. It really is.
Yeah, brilliant. Right, let's give it another spin. Okay, here we go. Number 49. Do you have it?
No. Oh, I do actually. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
nice one.
Look at that.
No, that's not bad at all. Number 49. If you could choose one person to interview, I know you said you'd never want to interview again, but who would it be?
Oh God. It was always Muhammad Ali, you know. It was always Muhammad Ali, and I met him in New Jersey in 1992. I was covering a boxing match, and I was staying in a hotel in the Meadowlands Hilton Hotel in New Jersey, and I was sort of standing outside, grabbing some late night evening air, and this limo just pulled up in front of me, and I saw Muhammad Ali get out of the back, and I just said, I got to interview him, you know, I have to interview him. And so I was chatting to the bellboy at the front of the hotel, and I said, I kind of knew him to chat to, you know, and I said, oh my God, is that Muhammad Ali? And he said, oh yeah, he comes here all the time, stays here all the time. And I said, can I bring his bags up to his room? And he went, yeah, no problem. Also, he gave me the trolley, and we put the bags on the trolley and pushed it to the lift. And he had a small entourage with him. His wife was with him, and I think he had sort of two or three people with him. And I pushed this thing into the lift, and I'm pretending to be the bellboy. Mm. And we got in, and it was just me and Muhammad Ali in the lift, and the minder was about to get in, got called away to do something, and the doors closed, and it's just the two of us in the lift. And he had Parkinson's syndrome then, like, so he couldn't, you know, he couldn't articulate, and it was the tragedy, like, you know, that this man whose greatest gift was talking, after boxing, was talking. Mm. He was robbed of his voice, you know. And I sort of tried to chat to him in the lift, but he started doing magic tricks for me. You know, he had this handkerchief and he made it disappear. And then he started throwing punches at me, like missing by inches, like, you know, with 2 inches from my nose, flicking out the jab. And I pushed the cart down to the room, and in we went. And I'm kind of thinking, right, you know, tell him now, you're a journalist, you know. I didn't really have the heart to do it, but he gave me $20 for bringing his bags up. And wow. And then, you know, and then said, you a chump, as he said to me, you a chump. And then off I went, you know. But I mean, and, you know, if I could go back in time and interview anybody in the history of the world, it would be Muhammad Ali at his prime, you know, Muhammad Ali in the 60s or 70s. Like, I just think he would be he would just be such a fascinating person to talk to.
When you're around those kind of people, like literally the best of all time in what they do, Can you feel it? Like, is there a tangible thing that you're like, yeah, I completely believe that you are an exceptional human?
Yeah, I mean, with him there was, you know, the, you know, he had an aura. There's no doubt about that. Like, you know, and a lot of that is down to the way he walked, the way his, you know, he it's almost like he grew in majesty when he lost the power of articulation. It was the. There was a sort of hush when he walked into a room. You could just feel it, you know. And when he walked, I mean, at that point he would just kind of shuffle along, and this circle just opened around him when he moved. And that doesn't happen for everyone. But it was just the respect he had, you know, for what he achieved in the ring, the victories he achieved for African American people, for, you know, anti-war campaigners, anti-Vietnam War campaigners, just an extraordinary character and a man of his times, you know. Like, there are, you know, if Muhammad Ali had been born in the 80s, he might have been quite, you know, just a sort of boring, you know, not boring, but he would have been just a really, really funny clown type character probably. But because he was born when he was just the right person for that time.
Yeah, sweet. Amazing. Right, we've got 10 minutes left. We'll try squeezing a couple. All right, here we go. Next out the gate, we have number 40. Do you have it?
No, I don't. No.
No worries. Number 40. The question is, if you weren't the nationality you are, what nationality would you choose to be?
Oh, I think French.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, 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 no doubt.
Bit of petulance. You
know, no, just, they're just the Gaelic shrug, the language, the food, you know. Like, I'm one of those people, when people say, oh, the, you know, French people can be very arrogant, I always just think, well, they can afford to be. They're French, like, you know. I've spent a bit of time in Paris over the years, just covering various sporting events. And I used to love just going down and using the metro and, you know, saying things in my leave insert French, and they just laugh in your face, like, you know. How dare you? How dare you try to speak this beautiful language with your Ballybrack accent, you know? And I'm no question French all the way.
Nice one. All right, sweet. All right, here we go. Next hit the gate, number 57. Do you have it?
No.
All right, number 57. Is there one thing that everyone likes that you don't like?
The Shawshank Redemption.
Oh.
Yeah.
What's the issue with it?
I thought it was a bit dull, actually. Yeah. I thought it was a bit dull until the, I mean, it's a great ending. I think it might be one of those movies that if it had a different ending, it would have been straight to DVD or something, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But the ending of it, I think, just kind of made it better, you know, seem better than it was. I don't know. And also, it's just it's like Peter Griffin says about The Godfather, you know, it insists upon itself. That's what I feel about The Shawshank Redemption. Just leaves me cold every time.
Yeah.
Just, yeah, yeah. And I've seen it loads of times. Like, yeah. You know, I can't, no one can say you haven't watched it all the way through.
Yeah,
I've watched it all the way through. I just don't get it.
All right. Fair. Good answer. All right. Number 58. Do you have it?
No.
In terms of artistic creation, what drives you to do what you do?
Things like, you know, with Coppers, the musical, and with the Ross books and the Ross plays, it's just making people laugh, you know. I love making people laugh, and it's been in me since I was a kid. My dad is very, very funny. My mother was very funny. My brothers are all very funny. We grew up in a house which was just full of laughter. And when we all sat around the table, and it's still the same, like, we all have dinner together on a Sunday, it's who's the funniest, who's the biggest clown around the table, who can make everybody laugh, who can get gag of the day. Like, that's it. If everybody says gag of the day, that's it. You're just made up.
Yeah.
And it was always like that growing up. And when I was in school, I was born in England, so I was kind of exempt. I was exempted from Irish for a couple of years. And when I went into secondary school, I took Irish, but I was just hopelessly behind everybody in the class. So I almost sort of checked out a bit, you know. And this great teacher, and she used to let me do this thing. She used to assign me these essays, like my life as a ping pong ball, or, you know, my life as a shoelace, which I would write just funny essays. And the end of the class on Friday, she would let me read them to the class and just try to make everybody laugh. And that, the feeling of that laughter, of reading something that you wrote and everybody laughing at it, never, ever lost. I still remember the thrill of that, you know. And it's exactly the same, like, when I write something for the stage. It's just sitting in the seat. And actually, there's a surprise element as well of what people will find funny, because often it's not the things that you think they're going to find funny. They laugh at a different line. But just the laughter. So I suppose all of the comedy stuff I do, that's the dynamic. It's just making people laugh. It's a joy. It's an absolute joy to hear people laugh at something you've written, you know.
Mm.
And it's quite a noble ambition as well, I think, you know, to make people laugh and bring them pleasure.
Totally. What do you find more nerve-wracking? Is it the first, say, let's talk about a play specifically, or a musical or something. Is it the first table read with the cast? Is it the first preview when it hasn't been read? Is there a point where you're kind of like, I don't know, does this work?
Yeah, but see, I get nervous going to see plays that I haven't written. Like,
yeah.
Right? There's something about live theatre. And I didn't go to the theatre much until I met my wife. And she's huge into the theatre. And And then I started to go a lot. And I think one of the reasons I was always I'm nervous that somebody's going to forget a line. I'm not talking about stuff I've written. I'm just talking about in general. And when somebody does forget a line, or if somebody corpses, my whole, like, I'm like, I tense, I'm just tense watching theatre.
Yeah.
And it's great. It's a fantastic experience. I saw The Price on Broad, just off Broadway last year, and Danny DeVito was in it. Yeah. And when we talked about art earlier, actually, I should have mentioned that probably ahead of Book of Mormon. But it was an amazing, amazing thing to see on stage, you know. And but I realized after, I had this headache afterwards, and it was just from being tense. Like, you know, it's live theater just makes me that way. But with something I've written, it's all the way, you know. You never know. You just don't know what's funny until other people are sharing it. And if you're writing a script, you're living with that script for 5-6 months, and jokes you've discarded, you're always thinking, was that a really funny joke I've thrown away? Like, for instance, we had with the last Ross O'Carroll Kelly play, Postcards from the Ledge, Rory Nolan plays Ross, and it's a one-man show.
Yeah.
And I had this line in it where he's talking about his children and raising kids. And he has this line. He says, children, you keep them alive. That's the job. And everything else is gravy. Or as we say on this side of the city, jus. And we cut that line. And afterwards, Jimmy Fay, who directed, said I cut it. And I thought Jimmy cut it. And Rory, there was some debate between us as to who cut it.
Yeah.
And I think it was cut because it sounded, the lead into it sounded a bit sentimental. I thought that's a little bit over sentimental. And I think that's why it was cut. But we lost this joke about jus, which I didn't think, I thought it was a throwaway thing anyway. And about 4 days from the end of the run in the Gaiety, Rory Nolan, I was having a pint with him after one of the shows. And he said, whatever happened to that line? And I said, yeah. I said, I can't remember why we cut that. He said, what if I say it tomorrow? And as happened, I was bringing friends in the following night. And he says this line, and it brought the house down, right? It brought the house. Everybody started clapping. And there's like, 30 seconds of clapping, because he said, as we say on this side of the city, jus. It's 30 seconds of clapping afterwards. And that doesn't often happen,
no.
You know, in the theatre. So you never know. I mean, and I'm probably, you know, as poor a judge as anybody of what's actually funny, because with an audience, you'd never know.
And do you think in that instance, that was because there was that, like, even with Rory, he knows he's thrown this into a different part of the script, there's an edge to his delivery, he's probably a little bit unsure? Or do you think it was the actual sentimentality of it and the fact that it was heartfelt for a minute and then he just subverts it and flips it?
Yeah.
What do you think it was? Or is it a marriage? Like, was that reaction standard then? Was it always getting that applause break?
Yeah, it did. From then on, he did it for 4 more shows, and every single show was exactly the same response. And afterwards, as I'm walking out of the theatre, I can hear people saying, that was a great line, wasn't it? To each other, about you, you know? And that was the line people were taking home with them. We left it on the floor. Like, that was the director's cut, you know? And I don't know. I think it's probably, the idea of calling gravy jus, I suppose, speaks to that sort of Celtic Tiger pretentiousness that people are still aware of. People remember that, like, you know, where you couldn't say gravy, you had to say reduction or jus or some really sort of pretentious sounding thing. I think there was that. But also it was the sentimentality thing. It was and I've always been sort of conscious of that with Ross. If you give people 2 or 3 sentences of sentimentality, you have to pull it back by saying something that just kills everything they've heard before.
Totally. Yeah. Amazing. Right, we'll give it one more spin.
Sorry, my answers are very long. I don't think we've even had 6.
Oh, this has been great. This has been great. Right, here we go. Last one, number 28. Do you have it?
I don't.
No worries. Oh, number 28, kind of an interesting way to leave it on. Number 28, do you believe in love at first sight?
No, I don't think so. Not. I mean, just probably because it hasn't happened to me, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I fell in love with my wife very, very soon after meeting her and getting to know her. Mm. But I don't... I don't... I don't I don't think so. I mean, look, I mean, I certainly believe in attraction at first sight, and I believe in attraction that feels like love, and it's probably nature's way to get you to procreate. I believe in those chemical things.
Sure.
But love at first sight, I don't think so.
Yeah.
No, that's a terrible thing to say for a writer, isn't it? I definitely won't be writing rom-coms, I think.
I know, yeah. I mean, it's not the cinematic answer, but it's quite possibly more.
You know, the way we do have that cinematic thing in us that we that's how we expect our life to go. You know, when our loved ones die, we're going to be standing next to them in the hospital holding their hand when, you know, they close their eyes and the candle goes out. And often it doesn't happen like that. It happens when you leave your loved one and you go down the corridor and you have a cup of coffee, you know, yeah. And that's what happened when my mother died, you know, that I was sort of by her bedside. We were all by her bedside and I went down to get a can of Coke and, you know, and that's when life happens. It happens when you're off doing something else, you know.
Yeah. And with that, do you think that was, you know, the way they say that sometimes, that the person they don't want you to even witness it, you know, that way that they want the other person to be gone and that,
No, I don't think so. I never put those type of interpretations on things. I just think they're too convenient, you know. I mean, I'm an atheist, like, so I don't believe in celestial powers or anything like that. And I don't believe there's a greater, you know, there's a greater power controlling the universe. I don't believe in fate. I don't believe in any of those things. I believe in coincidence. Mm-hmm. And I believe that, you know, life is mostly just random acts, you know, random things that I walked here today. You know, I crossed over the road on the way here. If I'd left 5 minutes later, I might have been hit by the number 49. But, you know, that's how I look at life. Like, I do look at it as a series of coincidences and random acts and unfortunate events.
Brilliant.
Sorry.
What a way to end. Perfect. Paul Howard, thank you so much for
Thomas,
playing personally.
Absolute pleasure. Yeah, cheers. Great talking to you.
So guys, that was Paul Howard playing Personality Bingo with Tom Moore. And Paul, if you're listening, a massive thank you to you for taking the time to do it. It was a pleasure to sit down with you. It's kind of mad. Paul's someone whose books I read growing up. I mean, the Ross O'Carroll Kelly books were like such a pillar of like our childhood, because we kind of used to, you know, spoof the rugby school lads as someone kind of coming from the countryside, and you know, it was always just a bit of gas, like the senior cup, like on some level we were probably a bit jealous of it, on another level we were just kind of like, what on earth is this? So those books just perfectly encapsulated that, and it's amazing to see how Paul's managed to keep that character relevant over, you know, the guts of 20 years. It's absolutely incredible. And then to have such an amazing journalistic career behind him as well, and a play, and a, you know, as a musical theatre writer and a playwright, it's just bonkers, this the span of this guy's work. And to be such a nice fella on top of it all, kind of is the icing on top. As I said, it's our last week on stage. Get out and see Copperface Jacks the musical. I guarantee you it is an incredibly good night out. There's been people who've come and see the show, and I'm not exaggerating, 4 and 5 times. That is the rate of laughter that this, it comes at you so fast that sometimes you're missing jokes because of the fact you're still laughing at the last one. It's just amazing. It literally is a laugh every 10 seconds. And it's so fun to just buzz off audiences like that night after night. As always, a huge thank you to the boss woman, Erin Lindsay, for mixing, editing and producing this podcast. We could not do it without you, Erin. You are a star. A huge thank you as well to Leah Moore and Anthony Manley for the deadly theme music. As always, to Connor Nolan for our beautiful artwork. And of course, to Alan Bennett and Paddy O'Leary for having us as part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network. What a network it is to be part of. And I'm delighted to be here. Guys, please tune back in next week when the exceptional Peter McGann plays Personality Bingo with Tom Moore. Tom Moore.
If you want to support this podcast and get a full ad-free episode, sign up to Headstuff Plus.